Well, thank you very much, and would like to start by thanking Gwen for having invited me. When I was invited, I asked myself, am I a legal entrepreneur? And I thought, well, probably she considers me to be one because of my past, 6 years president of the advisory committee under this Convention on the Protection of National Minorities, and again since 3 years in the same position. I was not involved in drafting the Framework Convention, however, but therefore I thought I'm not an entrepreneur in that sense. But I learned this morning that there's a larger community, the epistemic community of lawyers, and from that sense then I probably consider myself also to be an entrepreneur in the drafting process. I will speak about this afternoon, but not about the drafting process, but from standard setting to standard implementation, basically sharing with you some of my experiences on our work in Strasbourg. Background, the FCNM, as I will call it for reasons of time, is a child of the early 90s. We had the dissolution of the Soviet Union, the outbreak of civil war in ex-Yugoslavia. The OSCE introduced the Office of the High Commissioner of National Minorities. The Council of Europe was tasked to act. The Assembly first proposed an additional protocol to the European Convention on Human Rights that was apparently seen by the member states as too difficult, too dangerous. So in 1993, in the midst of the Yugoslav war, a decision to draft a framework instrument. We come to that a bit later. Then it went very quick. 1994, drafting was finalized. A ratification process started in 1995, entry into force in 1998. And within 2 years, membership had risen to 30 member states, and then very briefly, very shortly, to 39 member states out of 47. And that it has remained stable since 6 years, and I don't think there will be any new member states for some time to come. The major political goals, I think, are two. The first one was at that time that the, well, managing minority-majority relations should not be longer, should not be left to the state primarily concerned, since these situations might evolve and destabilize the whole region. First one. The second reason was it should not be left to the states primarily, the states plural concerned. It should be elevated from bilateral relations to international relations. And then minority rights, again perceived as part of the human rights family. We have referred this morning, some speakers, to the situation in the interwar period after World War II. The idea was that non-discrimination provisions would do the job. Then we had already in the 1960s, ironically enough, it was Yugoslavia, which pressed for the inclusion of a minority rights provision in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. So on the UN level, we had protection of minorities, but not on the European level. So it was part of the human rights family. So in sum, the FCNM, the Framework Convention, is the legal basis for the internationalization, or rather Europeanization, of minority rights in Europe. Minority rights or minority situations in Europe are very different from country to country. So that was the main reason why the drafters were tasked to draft a framework convention. What does a framework convention is? It is not a traditional human rights instrument which gives rights, subjective rights, to the persons concerned, but it obliges states to adapt their domestic legislation and administrative practices to the international legal obligations which they have incurred by ratifying that international covenant. To put it more bluntly, give them more leeway. That's a framework only. That means that the major and primary, but not primary task probably, and the first task of the monitoring bodies working under the Framework Convention was to establish standards, to set standards in view of the fact that the wording of the provisions of the Framework Convention is, to put it positively, very flexible, to put it negatively, vague. What is a substantial number of persons belonging to a national minority? Is that 50% of the population? Is it 10%? And that you have to decide. So that was the kind of work which we had, which we were starting, and we were working and are working on the basis. Probably I should say that the main, and if you look at the text of the Framework Convention, the body tasked with the monitoring is the Committee of Ministers, a political body, which is assisted by an advisory committee. The interesting thing that is up to persons like you would be to find out why over the last 10 years it's the advisory committee which has become the actual the major actor in that field, I think at least. But I'm biased, of course, because I'm president of that body. Though I'm speaking, of course, I mean, that caveat I should have brought in the beginning, I'm speaking in my personal capacity and not as a president of that, you know. So we get every 5 years the state is obliged to present a state report. Then the advisory committee sets up a working group which is informed on whatever other information there is available, UN bodies, other Council of Europe bodies, NGOs to a very large extent. We receive shadow reports which are usually more interesting for us to read than the state reports, don't quote me on that. And then in the end we establish an opinion. The opinion indicates good practices, but also raises issues, and in some usually 4 or 5 situations we come to the conclusion that the situation in a country concerning a specific right is incompatible with the legal obligations of that country under the Framework Convention. Then this opinion is submitted to the governments, to all governments. They can comment on it, and then the Committee of Ministers comes into the play, and they will adopt eventually a relatively short resolution consisting of some recommendations what the country in question should do. This resolution is based on the findings of the advisory committee. Then there should be, in an ideal world, a follow-up seminar discussing with NGOs, with civil society, and with government the opinion and what to do to improve the situation in the country or to bring it in line with the international obligations. And then the next cycle of monitoring starts. For those countries for which the membership in the Framework Convention started in 1998, we are now in the third cycle. For example, the UK, the third opinion has been adopted a year ago. Now, standard setting, we have some 100 opinions of the advisory committee, some 80 recommendations of the Committee of Ministers. So I think that the standard, that the process of standard setting has been reached to quite a substantial level. In the sideline, it would be probably very interesting for persons like you, or potentially also for someone like myself, to see how are the actors in this entrepreneurial system, and we are very few. It's amazing, actually, how few people are involved in the work, actually in the work. There are 2 or 3 persons in the secretariat, and then out of the 18 members of the advisory committee, we are not more than that, there are usually not more than 5 or 6 people who are really doing the job. So it's a very small group of persons who actually is writing the opinion and has, to some extent, the accountability for the standard setting. Obviously, we are reading what the international community writes about it. We are in contact. We are not in a sort of immune world. But that we might come to that in the discussion. The standard setting is done by a very small group of persons with the, well, there's no democratic accountability or legitimity on our side, of course. We are nominated by country governments, elected or appointed by the Committee of Ministers, and we produce something which is soft jurisprudence based on hard law. And we had this development, this discussion this morning, how do you get, how does soft law turns into hard law? I mean, we are not talking about soft law. When we are interpreting hard law, we are setting standards based on hard law. It's not a court rendering hard jurisprudence based on hard law, but it's not like the European Committee Against Racism and Intolerance, another Council of Europe body, which has no treaty basis. And that would be soft law based on soft jurisprudence based on soft law. Anyway, I think we have the standard setting is to some extent more or less achieved based on this comparative study of these opinions. We have adopted 2 general commentaries, one on participation, one on education, and we'll adopt one on linguistic rights in May. And that is done in a more open way. I mean, there we have made a draft which has been presented to stakeholders, to use this term, governments and the leading NGOs in the field and the leading academics, and we have that input. In the end, it's our commentary, so it's we who decide what we want to take in it. It's not a general commentary on the framework convention as such. It is a commentary by the advisory committee. So the implementing of such standards, which, as I said, constitute at the very best soft jurisprudence, poses specific challenges because there is no specific implementation process. The implementation process is part of the monitoring process. So what we do is we see what was the recommendation or finding in the first cycle of monitoring. Then we compare that situation with the second cycle of monitoring information we get. And then we come to the conclusion, the country has done what we asked it to do. Great. That is laudable, and that is a positive development, and as such will be referred to in the opinion. And nothing has changed, or not enough has changed, that would be reflected then in the language. You start in the first opinion that you are concerned about the situation. The second opinion will tell the country we are deeply concerned, or maybe we are already of the opinion that the situation is incompatible with the framework convention. The third cycle of opinion, language gets stronger. But in the end, we cannot do more than just appealing to the political bodies to do something. So even the Committee of Ministers cannot do more than just appealing to the recommending to the state in question to act in a specific way. This is not a court handing down a judgment. We understand each other as a facilitator for the internal dialogue in the country, and what we want is that the internal actors, civil society, NGOs, minority representatives, government, whoever is interested, all the stakeholders, take up our findings and use them as a basis for their discussion. And that is increasingly, I think, taking place, or has been taking place increasingly over the last decade. The venue to do that, the ideal VN venue, would be those follow-up seminars where one could discuss things. This effect that our findings are more and more used in the internal debates might explain, and that is my last point, two challenges which we are facing right now that I think have to do with the general attitude among European states, and that is pan-European most unfortunately. Also the old member states of the Council of Europe seem to be more reluctant to accept international scrutiny and international monitoring. And just to remind you in this country of the reaction in the British media about the court's judgment on the voting rights of prisoners, or in my country the reaction against the court judgment on preventive detention of sexual offenders. The language used in the media by politicians, I think, would not have been used in Germany some 10 years ago. And in the UK, I have not heard anything since the McCann judgment of that really hard language. For us, and I see that when I come to the Committee of Ministers and present opinions and have to defend them. The language used, the rigor with which some of the findings are questioned is much stronger than it was during my first 6 years of president, between 1998 and 2004. Then it was much more, I thought, cooperative. Now there are some countries which are very strong about not accepting the findings. There is opposition against the strong role which the advisory committee has achieved in the monitoring process. There are ideas floating around that there should be limitations on the independence, or that the opinion before it gets final and public should be discussed with government authorities, which we refuse, of course, because that would be, in our understanding, the end of our independence. The second most unfortunate development which we are facing is the strong revival of bilateralism. In the Committee of Ministers, a number of resolutions which are not adopted but adopted by consensus traditionally. We've heard that the Council of Europe is working on a consensus basis. They are blocked by kin states. We have an increasing number of situations where kin states or other states with what they consider to be vested interests block the adoption of a resolution on a specific country. And that is not only in countries where you would expect that, maybe Georgia and Russia, there are obvious problems, but even among EU member states. Poland and Lithuania have engaged in a battle over the pertinent minority rights. So that is a tendency which we are now asking ourselves, why do we have that tendency? Is it that states have recognized now the seriousness, the importance of the Framework Convention, of the standard setting and the implementation Dunbars, so that in the beginning they did not consider that instrument to be of relevance for their domestic situation? That is our understanding, because we do not feel that we have been overstepping our competences. It might be, of course, also that the language is becoming stronger, that we try to move forward, that we try to get more effect on the domestic situation and discussion. Our answer to the critiques from governments usually is, well, invite us, have a follow-up seminar so we can discuss the issue in the country itself, so we can help finding a solution. I would like to conclude maybe by saying that, in contrast to governments, those organizations which maybe are even more our clients than the governments, that is NGOs representing minorities, usually are very much in favor of our findings. And some governments have adopted a position, which we find, of course, very laudable, that they would add to their very critical comments to our opinion the comments of the organizations representing the national minorities. And I mean, I can speak about Germany without problem, I can say. And there we have the critical comments by the government, and then the very supportive comments by organizations of the Danish-speaking minority or the Sorbian minority. And that's then the situation when you can sort of lean back and say, okay, it can't be all wrong what you are doing. Thank you for your attention.